listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favorite authors.
Today, we welcome Kevin Spiteri, strategic marketer, serial entrepreneur, digital and social media specialist, agency owner, startup investor, and devoted father, to chat about his new book, I Just Want It to Work, a guide to understanding digital marketing and social media for frustrated business owners, managers, and marketers. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, Danny. Hi, Chris. And hello to all the Words and Nerds followers.
What's the first thing that you see in people that they don't quite understand when it comes to social media?
I think the biggest thing that's misunderstood is the, let's call it, the difference or the delineation between Facebook as a powerful business tool and as a, you know, multiple mediums or multiple, you know, forms of social media that enable two-way dialogue versus, I think, what the average user presumes or what sort of concocts from their use of social media. So that's probably the thing I would deal with the most, I guess, if that answers your question. It's just, you know, the world I see, the way I see social media, and the way, say, the average person sees social media when you start the conversation about, you know, social media in particular, which is only, you know, it's a portion of what I do. It's not all of it, but that seems to be the thing. It's like, oh, so do you do Facebook pages? Like, yeah, something like that. Went into a day in the life of us and how we study the algorithm and every change that's made, the platforms, the types of communications, what's trending, all that sort of stuff. It's just a whole new world. And to be honest, when you come home for a day, you really don't want to use social media.
I find personally, you used a word there that I find is always interesting, and it sort of separates out for me people who use it just socially or have used it for business, which is the word algorithm, which I always find really, really fascinating. When you mention the algorithm on Facebook, for example, the algorithms on Twitter, and you get blank stare. What algorithm? What is this? The other one is the differentiation between platforms is something I've found, and obviously I assume you've seen as well, and understanding the purposes of different platforms and the best way to hit a market on different platforms.
Absolutely.
Like, for example, people who think that you repost your Facebook post as a Twitter post, or you repost that as an Insta post, when they're very different platforms, and the way you target are obviously then going to be very different as well.
Do you think there's an oversaturation of Facebook pages and Twitter and things like that at the moment?
Yeah, I think there are plenty of channels, and I think that oversaturation, definitely, you know, from a content perspective, I think what we find is that every channel has a very specific purpose and promotes a particular behavior, a certain type of behavior. And because of that, and this is a bit that I love, you know, I'm a strategic marketer first and foremost, so my job is to get in the minds of individuals. And what what we have to understand is the channels that are obviously most appropriate to the audiences, then understand how they behave on those platforms and what they're for, because each of them do have a place. And regardless of the amount of saturation, the amount of time and energy being spent, and the amount of content consumed on these platforms are phenomenal. And so it's definitely there's definitely a lot of saturation, but it's almost negligible in a sense in the grand scheme of things, in that if people are using it and they're using it in all different ways. And that's something that we have to be aware of and understand how to tap into.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you about was with regards to Twitter. And we're talking about using social media platforms in different ways, and they've got different purposes, and there's different, obviously, nuances to how you use them. What do you think about the expanded Twitter account that's recently made its emergence? One of the things that I find with Twitter is that one of the joys of Twitter is you need to know what your message is, and you need to be able to delineate that into the characters. And I wonder if expanding that Twitter you know, doubling the amount of characters you can use sort of starts to loosen that message a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great question, Chris. And I know there's probably going to be some marketers out there that would disagree with me, but I'm not a huge fan, nor am I personally a big user of the Twitter platform, quite interestingly. And the reason being is, again, when you understand your target audience and who uses it, and just the sheer, you know, the sheer volume of users, Twitter, especially in Australia, has nowhere near the amount of penetration of, you know, the likes of Facebook and Instagram. So that's your first challenge. The second thing is that you're right to answer your question about the, you know, the loosening up of the word count. It shows you their struggle, I believe, as a platform to stay relevant in the needs or relevant to the needs of the user base. And that's why Facebook has succeeded for so long, has continued to go from strength to strength. It's not like, you know, it didn't last a whole of 3 or 4 years like MySpace did before it sort of crashed and burned. It's managed to stay relevant because it's been able to deliver everything that the population, the mass population, wants within the one platform. It's why they purchased Instagram, so that they could still maintain relevancy, more so from an advertising perspective, but again from the channeling of content across two very specific channels to get the ultimate result for the individual using it. So I think it's Twitter's way of attempting to become more relevant, and it's a little bit, I mean, if you have to go back to the core, it's a little bit disappointing because you're right, is what made Twitter great was the fact that you had to actually think about what you wrote. It made you witty. It made you be very clear and concise about your core message, and it was a great way of using words and articulation to get people's attention really quickly. But what we understand is that the share of attention is now so fragmented and that attention spans are so minimal that they're obviously trying to claw back a bit of relevance.
And do you think that's why I find looking at authors all the time that Instagram has exploded so much? Like, I'm talking the difference between an author with 26,000 followers on Instagram and then I'm going to their Facebook page and they have 500.
There is, and there's a number of reasons. I mean, Instagram is absolutely the fastest growing platform, and again, that's been realized through Facebook's acquisition of Instagram. Mm. So it benefits Facebook regardless. What we also find is that, you know, the purpose of Instagram is very much for the visual journey that it's taking its users on. And then the ability to to post cross platform. So you might find with a lot of my content, I'll originate my posts on Instagram and they'll end up being posted on Facebook as well. So it starts with Instagram and then is posted on Facebook. The other thing with the separation between the followers, there's two major things at play here. The first is that a lot of Instagram accounts, it's quite common to use bots to generate engagement with people who are relevant or whom you believe could be your target audience. So, you know, you can set, there are programs that you set parameters of the types of followers you want, and then it goes and, you know, automates the engagement with those followers in order to then gain, with those people to gain followers. So so that's typically, whereas Facebook doesn't have that aggregate, you know, Facebook requires advertising to build an audience, or a lot of great content being shared regularly and literally built, you know, from the ground up. And I see it with myself, you know, I've only got a small following on Facebook. Again, my purpose has never been to build a huge following, because as you would have read in my book, the adage that I use is, would you rather be in a room where you're speaking to 50 people, all of whom have your attention, or would you rather be in a stadium filled with 50,000 people where only 50 people have your attention? That for me is, that's the reason why you get that gap in numbers. So it's a lot easier to gain those followers on Instagram. And the other thing that Instagram does really well is, of course, the hashtags. So the use of hashtags also amplifies your ability to grow your following organically, whereas hashtags on Facebook are less relevant because people aren't actively using it to find trending matters on Facebook.
And it always feels a little bit weird when you see the hashtags on Facebook. And I prefer Twitter as a platform personally. I agree 100% with the difference between a tweet versus a Facebook post in terms of that audience reach. And then again with Instagram, Twitter would get clicks, but not interactions. And, you know, there's a big difference between the two. And then Instagram, again, would just take off way past what Facebook does. I think Twitter has its place, but Twitter is more a conversation, whereas Facebook and the others allow for a bit more in-depth engagement. Twitter's the casual conversation you're having with someone at a bar.
It's why I tend not to recommend it, and it's rare that I would recommend it, if any, for businesses. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, unless they were, I don't know, a boutique fashion label, which I might have worked with, I think that would probably only be the only exception of where, you know, if they're fashion or media-based, where Twitter might be more relevant. But the average business, you know, the average service-based business, and even to a degree product-based business, the use and activation of Twitter is less relevant, and more so because what I'm about is cutting the shit when it comes to the selection of strategies for businesses' marketing. And I think there's a general overwhelm from businesses out there as to what platforms they should activate. Mm. And that's one of the, you know, that's one of the challenges that they face. And as such, it's really important that we help reduce that overwhelm and keep them focused and putting their energy into the channels that we know from experience and research that will generate the best returns for the business. And ultimately, that's all that matters at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's right. Because you can spend your time going across all platforms, and like you say, Twitter could be completely irrelevant to you. We could talk about social media probably all night, but we'll move on. I think it's a huge topic and really relevant today. You describe yourself as a dadpreneur, which I love. What are the unique challenges or qualities that make it different from being an entrepreneur, besides the obvious fact of having children, do you think?
Yes, it's a great question. And you know, when I think about it, and I recently wrote that article about dadpreneurs in particular, I think the way I distinguish it, or the reason why that I guess I've titled it in that manner, is because for me, there's lots of entrepreneurs out there. There's so many people that have backed themselves and are creating businesses. What I know, though, is that backing yourself, or one of the things that I felt is that when you back yourself as a father to take the leap out of corporate world, mm-hmm. Or out of business to do it yourself, it's bloody scary. And without sounding sexist, as I think for a lot of, you know, for many fathers, who have the, you know, we can't bear children, so that's up to our wives to bear the children, or the women to bear the children. So if you know, when you know you've got children on the way, and your, let's call it, your one job, you know, is to keep the money coming in during that time, even for the short period of time before your partner can go back to work, mm-hmm. There's a shitload of responsibility, and there's the massive amount of pressure attached to it. And, you know, I know for me, in my personal circumstance, you know, I've got a beautiful wife. She's a hairdresser. There was always the choice. I always said that I wanted her to have the choice, and we wanted her to have the choice whether she worked or not. And she was able to choose how she worked. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where the difference in the dadpreneur is, that I had the guts to leave a corporate job. So I was, you know, a big six-figure corporate world, Fortune 500, et cetera, role, to do it myself. And when you go from that to nothing, there's a lot of play there. And I think that's the angle of the dadpreneur. It's the guys that are making the shift to build a business and a life around their families their partners and their children that are on their terms. Mm-hmm. And that for me was my sole objective. Was I knew I had twins were coming, and you know, I owned a business down in Melbourne. I lived in Melbourne at the time when we found out the twins were coming. And that was, I said to Danielle, I said, you know, like, now's the time. Like, we need to go back to the coast. I want my girls to grow up on the beach. We found out later that they were girls, obviously, but I want my girls to grow up on the beach. I want us to have, you know, this is the sort of lifestyle I want. And I just didn't want to go back into the corporate world, which would have been the easiest thing to do, was to slot back into that. But I knew what sort of support and help was going to be required, and you know, what was going to be needed from me to bring up the twins. And so I built my whole business, and that's where I guess Menace started, my agency started, was I built my whole life around and my whole business around those girls and around, yeah, around the children. And now I have a son who's about to turn one in a couple of days' time, in 6 days' time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having three children and the fact that, that I get to make the, you know, I get to call the shots and I get to make the rules when it comes to the way I, you know, the time I can spend with them, the attention I can give them, everything shaped around them. Admittedly, you work harder than you, than I probably ever have, to be quite honest. However, the type of work and the pressure and the, you know, you're only limited by yourself and you're only, governed by your own, you know, you're your own worst enemy, your own worst critic, etc. So that to me, I think is almost the punishment. The punishment for all of the perks that come along with it is that nobody's going to hand a paycheck to you at the end of the month and go, you know, job well done. Not that they ever said job well done.
Is it work harder in a corporate world?
Yeah, work harder.
It's a lovely and welcoming environment for yes. all.
That's right. It was like there's 24 hours in a day, and then there's overtime. That used to be the corporate mantra that I worked around. So, you know, I think that's where the dadpreneur angle came from, and why I wanted to, I guess, help a lot of other. There's never been a better time, and I want to help other people, not just fathers, but anyone. Take that leap into their own business. It's not for everybody, but for those that are, I felt that, you know, I could help by providing a bit of guidance and things to think about and to consider when getting out there into the into the entrepreneurial world or starting your own business.
And I guess that's the important thing of showing that personal and human side as well. You know, I've noticed your Facebook page especially, which I really like. It shows, you know, all the business stuff and the videos that you do, but then also shows, you know, some pictures of your girls and stuff. So is that important to balance what you're showing to your audience, a bit of personal, a bit of business? And how do you draw the line and how do you balance that?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question because, you know, I have people, the first step is they find it, some people find it hard to get in front of a camera, you know, to put themselves out there, let alone to then go and share their lives. I guess to me is that what I know and understand is that in one of the things that I challenge in the marketing world is the whole delineation between B2B and B2C. So for listeners, you know, business to business versus business to consumer. And what I challenge is that today is about people to people. So it's people doing business with people, and it doesn't matter whether it's in a business setting or a consumer setting. The point is that people relate to people, and it's important, and I think it's easy to be lost or to be sort of hidden behind a business, and people forget or not necessarily be aware of you being a human. You know, they see you as a function or as a service. And it's important to create that personality. I want, you know, my followers, and I want people who I do business with, and I'm very fortunate that I get to choose now who I do business with. I want them to know who I am, and I don't, you know, and I don't want to have to make any apologies for it either. So, and that's what I love is that because I've been able to build my business around my family, all of my clients know where my family sit on that priority. If I'm away, my clients know to leave me alone. If I am, if I have to work from home for whatever reason, they know there's a good chance there's going to be, you know, screaming in the background.
like this podcast, possibly.
Yeah, like this podcast. Well, I mean, they're in bed, and I've taken the precaution of locking them in their room in case they decide to go on a nighttime rampage. But, they know. And I think that personality is important because it creates a level of relation. Mm-hmm. It's a common ground, and it's something that I know a lot of my clients tend to relate to. So where I draw the line is there is a limit to how personal I get with, you know, sharing stories. I tend to keep it more macro, I guess, so that there's a level of familiarity, but without, you know, exposing my personal life or being too, what's the word? I guess you know, I guess there is a thing called overshare. And
yeah. We all know that person.
That's right. Tell my business customers about, you know, my children's toilet training. Like, that's probably the last
thing. Or Instagramming it. That's the other.
Instagramming the body training exercise. And that's where keeping it relevant is important. You know, family people relate to family people, and that's the level of depth that I would tend to share.
I liked in the book talking about relationships. You know, obviously everything is about relationships, as you say, and creating community. But there's this idea of creating a tribe, you know, those loyal followers who share your work for you. And how do you create that tribe, and how do you find your tribe?
Yeah, that is that's the holy grail in social media. And it takes a phenomenal amount of work and focus. So the easiest way to answer that is that it starts with your brand. It starts with who you want to be known for, and then exuding that in everything you do. So every piece of content has that brand image or that personality attached to it. Your next step is once you're really clear on who you are and who you want to do business with, The next bit is finding those people you want to do business with. So, you know, I know for me, if I had to say there was a sweet spot, I find my best customers are the ones that sort of are sitting in their, let's call it their late 30s right through to maybe early 50s. Men and women in senior roles in organizations, they're the guys that are tasked with a marketing function or have a marketing function that they're responsible for or have, direct reports, and they just want to manage it better. And because they're unfamiliar with it, or they just don't get the digital or social side, they're the ones that I relate to the best and the ones that I find I direct a lot of my content towards. So once you are crystal clear on who it is you want to relate to and do business with, the next part of building that tribe is getting that content in front of them. And there's a number of strategies that you can use to do that or to grow that tribe organically. So that's where you might reach out to people who you know might be an influencer in that space. So, let's just say I made skateboards. If I had a skateboard business, I might go out and potentially reach out to some maybe amateurs or up and coming skaters that are maybe, you know, starting to look like they're getting sponsors and maybe looking to turn pro. I might reach out to them. You know, they might have a pretty good follower base. And then I would ask them, hey guys, you know, if you like the content, I really appreciate it if you could share it, see it. I'll do the same for you. And you work really hard with individuals building that, building that tribe or building that almost that referral system. That's the organic way. The other way is using paid methods. So that's where you'd use, Facebook advertising, Instagram advertising, even website advertising, to start targeting the very specific people you want, and then making sure your content is consumed by them so that they then engage with you and then start to follow your page. And that's the other way that you can grow your tribe.
If you share a lot every day and it's not on task and on message and of value, people start tuning you out, and it actually has the opposite effect there. And that's something where, again, with, as you mentioned before, with Facebook ads and that targeting, paid targeting strategy of being able to pay for and target that audience that you know is likely to want that message and want to hear it. It's also about, from what I've seen, and you can speak to this obviously, making sure that it's something relevant to say and it's not overburdening people with the same thing day in, day out to the point where they don't want to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I faced that a lot probably in the early days of business, where I'd go into client meetings and that would be the stuff that they requested. You know, we've got to have a super long post. You know, these are the words we have to use. You know, here's the one image. And when you sat there, I mean, it takes a bit of time to earn the respect. But what we find is that, you know, once they start to trust you, and they start to understand the value that you bring to the equation, they quickly learn that that their strategy is misinformed. And you're right, you know, these long-winded, irrelevant posts at the wrong times are not going to get that. And to be quite frank, one of the biggest benefits of authoring my book is that I don't do business with anybody now that hasn't read my book. And so my process on onboarding a client after, say, an initial call would be that they get a copy of my book and that they would read the book before we then engage in the next conversation. Yeah. Or typically we go from the book into a strategy session. We run a full-day strategy session where we unpack a client's business and their objectives. And from those objectives, then we determine the strategies and then the best tactics to employ in their business. And that could be everything from, you know, a traditional marketing, you know, TV campaign right through to, an SEO strategy or a Google AdWords strategy or a fully automated marketing automation strategy. So it's that process and getting them to read the book first and having that right information helps make the conversations a lot better because it sets the scene. As I said, the whole purpose of the book was to help give business owners, managers and marketers that understanding before those conversations took place.
You say it best when you describe the content in your book, like that friend you know and trust at a dinner party who provides some great insight, advice and information that really resonates with you on a particular topic. So thinking about your content in that way, I think is really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you'll probably notice when you see my videos is I'm very conscious to keep jargon down to a minimum, and I want to come from a position of or a place of simplicity, because there's enough tech geeks out there, and I'm guilty, of being one of them. It's very easy to overcomplicate this, and that overcomplication causes, that the overwhelm that's created by that then generates fear. And the last thing we need is business owners in the world making decisions out of fear, which is what tends to happen and why they tend to go down the wrong path, because they're scared. And so they're more inclined to trust that, person at the dinner party who has some form of credibility in that space than the business and, the number of sharks that are out there trying to sell them a particular service or a particular product, where that was, if that's the angle you're coming from with your content in helping to provide jargon-free, easy to understand and a really simplistic view on the challenges and problems and issues that those businesses face, it helps. It gives you that bit of credibility that's equivalent to the valued opinion of somebody that you would speak to at a dinner party.
I also love the question you pose in the book. I think you ask it twice. You say, are you knowledgeable enough to be dangerous? What's it mean to be dangerous? And how did this idea come about? So I really liked it. It made me think.
Yeah. So I've got a whole philosophy around my view on marketing. So, being an ex-corporate marketer with, an eight-figure budget I was dealing with at the time. And what I saw was that so many marketers and agencies were really happy to be unaccountable for their actions. And so when I founded my business, I called it Menace, specifically because I wanted to stir the pot when it came to the marketing fraternity. What I also believed and what I know is that whilst I have all the qualifications and I've literally been through the traps of every bit of study, imaginable in the marketing fraternity, a lot of those theories and a lot of the marketing principles were developed in the 50s and 60s. And the two things that they didn't account for that weren't accounted for primarily were the dawn of the internet and social media. And So where that philosophy, I guess, stems from is that I wanted to make marketers, including myself, accountable for our actions and for their actions. And so I knew the only way I could do that was if I could help educate business owners, managers of marketers, across the marketing spectrum or across the way you would employ strategies or what they would need to be aware of in order to make sound decisions. And that's where the idea of becoming dangerous came from, because often businesses rely, you know, that those decision makers are relying on them trusting somebody, whether it's an employed marketing person or an outsourced agency, to advise them on the best approach of the best strategy. And so I actually wanted to help them become dangerous in the boardroom, dangerous in agency meetings, dangerous when it comes to recruiting a marketer, and just making sure that these guys aren't talking shit. And that's the, like, that's the idea of becoming dangerous, is that they can hold them to task, and that they know how to keep them accountable, and they know what questions to ask, and they know how to challenge the conversation to see if they, you know, to weed out the baddies from the goodies.
It's one of the things that I've sort of noticed a little bit on the line that you were talking about there before, is that an understanding of that old worldview versus the newer technology and the impact of social media and the way that people engage with technology. And the one line that is always used is that any publicity is good publicity idea. And I think with regards to online marketing, that's something that actually the younger generation who have grown up more with the media would instantly rebuff, the idea of things like clickbait, the idea of the way that marketers use those sorts of targeted strategies. And it tends to be that this younger market, we want that they go, oh, we want the younger market, we're going to target the younger market with the media. But what I think, again, talking, you know, obviously you have seen more about this than I do, but just from my experience, younger people who have grown up with this technology are the first ones to see right through it.
Yeah.
And that idea of any publicity is good publicity, they'll click on it, and a click means that we're going well. Not always.
Not always, no. And that's, yeah, that's spot on. And interestingly, it's the big businesses. So the big businesses that tend to still be so guilty with that. They think they're employing the newest, latest and greatest strategies, but they're not. And are often, especially the corporates, they're the worst offenders, because they're so regimented and they're so bound by their bureaucracy and their, you know, their I don't know, their brand personas that somebody's convinced them, you know, that they need to adhere to, that and the process to get to customer often goes astray. And you're right, the younger generation, specifically 25 and even 20 and under, they are so savvy to it that it's so much harder to, you know, they want an absolutely authentic experience. And it's why influencers are so important, why influencers are such a big part of a good, I guess, market penetration strategy, is because that's what they do. You know, they idolize, they follow, they've grown up, they're the YouTube generation, you know, they've grown up consuming content from people that have influenced them on everything that they like or enjoy, from you know, toys to vehicles, you know, as they get older, from makeup to, you know, from cosmetics to jewelry to fashion to sporting equipment, all of that's at play. And what they want is they just want to get to the, you know, they just want to get to the truth. They don't care about the features and benefits. They just want to know, hey, what's in it for me? Is that the right thing for me? Am I going to be like that? Or do I have a greater chance of being, you know, better, look better, feeling better, having more fun, whatever it might be? And is this the product for me?
It's the difference between understanding the word clicks and the word engagement. And I think a lot of people who don't understand it view clicks as the grail, when it's engagement, time spent on page, time engaged with content, that is actually what
or worse impressions. And you know, that was, you know, for me back in the early days, you know, when I'd have an agency sit in front of me and go, Kevin, we've got 1 million impressions, and I'd say, oh, that's fantastic. So how many people engaged with us?
One.
And Hey, let me check. You know, I have to ask somebody that question. Great question. So you're right. The metrics are everything, and understanding, you know, and again, what I've attempted to do in my book is get an understanding of the metrics and how to use them to calculate things like ROI, or how to more so create objectives first and foremost that are aligned with various strategies. So, you know, for instance, I'm not a fan of just brand awareness in isolation. You know, a lot of traditional marketers would sit there and go, you know, just slap your brand anywhere, mate, you'll be fine. That's all, and you know, job's done. Get it on a billboard, bus stop, you're done.
Relevance.
And I vehemently disagree with that. It's, you know, if brand awareness, yes, that is a required strategy, but link it with another objective, link it with engagement, link it with audience building, link it with, you know, link it with lead generation, link it with, you know, engagement of, you know, of any form. Just don't sit brand awareness out there by itself and say you've done your job.
Something I found interesting from your book was the idea of 12 touches, so that a person, once they have to see or hear your name or business 12 times before they take action. Initially, I thought, really, 12 times? But then I thought about the pages I started to like, and I think that's true for me. I don't know if exactly 12, but I know it's a number of times before I have liked a page.
It's a really cool one, because when I started off in marketing, so let's call it 17-odd years, the number used to be 5, okay. And it was somewhere around 4 and 5. This is, as I said, going on nearly 17 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so, as you can imagine, and that was at a time where the primary channels to market were TV, radio, print, which was all what they used to call above the line strategies. So mainstream media, and then below the line were things like direct marketing, direct mail, email marketing, that sort of stuff that's supposed to be personalized and, you know, come to me. Now, with the encore of so many digital and social channels erupting, the amount of messages that we're being exposed to, and even the different mediums, even the different above the line mediums that exist now, that we're being exposed to, have obviously increased, and the amount of messaging has increased. So what we know is that as marketers, it takes longer for somebody to be touched by a brand before they engage. And so what that means is the average equation is 12 touches. So an individual is touched 12 times, usually across 4 different channels. Mm-hmm. And they need to have spent somewhere between 4 to 8 hours of time engaging or being exposed to a brand in some way before action takes place. And it is quite an average, but we use that as a guide, because what often happens is people think, oh, look, I'll just do an ad campaign on social media and I'm going to be a millionaire. And if it were that simple, and that you could just put a product up on you know, social media and become a millionaire overnight, everyone would be millionaires. Clearly it's not. And that's because you're fighting for individuals' attention. And so being present multiple times but adding value in that process is what's important. So a touch could be anything from, you know, somebody seeing an ad, somebody seeing a piece of content, somebody reading a book, somebody hearing something on a podcast, somebody seeing it in a catalog, you know, an article in a newspaper. Each one of those forms are touches. It could be a billboard, anything where an individual is exposed to that marketing message. Then, of course, your 4 different channels are the different mediums. So it could be social media, it could be online, it could be in a book, it could be on a podcast, same sort of thing. So it's which channel has that message being conveyed on, and then the time they spend. So we know as marketers that the more time somebody spends engaging with a brand, the greater chances of them purchasing or, you know, commercially transacting with that brand.
Yeah, I think a lot of the time, you know, we talk about the influencers and talk about that engagement. And as you said before, you know, put it on social media and you'll be rich. I think a lot of people who don't quite understand it see when mainstream media, for example, writes an article about PewDiePie and what he's done on YouTube, or you know, Captain Sparkle's owning a $15 million house in California. and all these YouTubers making millions upon millions and goes, oh, there we go, it's easy. That's what happens. Look at the media, they're talking about it. Not understanding the years and years of built up exposure and interaction, and that 12 touches is, you know, far more than that, because they're on everything that moves on social media, on all platforms, and it's more engaging, not just general face value.
And it takes 1 to 3 years, which I read from your book, to build that decent community. So it's quite a long time with social media. You know, imagine what it was before social media, when you couldn't access people as easily. One technique I was really interested in, and you mentioned in your book, and I was surprised by, were handwritten letters. Is this a thing?
Absolutely. It is probably single-handedly one of the most valuable strategies that I have, you know, that I've given away freely in the book, and that I share with clients on a regular basis, obviously where it's relevant. But the context in which I spoke about the handwritten letter is primarily when you're trying to reach decision makers who are of an older demographic. This is the sweet spot, but I know even when I say older demographic, 35 plus, it resonates with extremely well, but more so the 50 plus. They're extremely time poor. They're less likely to consume a lot of media. They're typically in high-end professional roles. That strategy, yeah, as I said, has single-handedly been one of the most valuable strategies that I've advised and given to clients. And the reason being is it does a couple of things. The first thing it does is it sparks an element of nostalgia and appreciation for, you know, let's call it the days gone by, or a technique that is seldom used. It is so easy to just shoot an email, to shoot a text, to ping somebody, to, you know, Facebook Messenger them, to LinkedIn message them. It's so easy to do that. And we're all getting bombarded with that. The one thing that you can't dispute is that when a letter, when something physically, mail physically still shows up in your letterbox or you're at your office, and it's a small card, or it's a, you know, a nice envelope. I use this strategy quite regularly, where, you know, I've got a nice parchment card with my logo embossed on it, and I've just written a short note to someone to thank them for something, or to ask for 10 minutes of their time to have a quick conversation, whatever it might be. The amount of cut through that gets, that in somebody's mind, they go, wow, so this guy took the time to create a method, you know, to create these cards, to write on them, to post them out, and is acknowledging me as an individual in a way that I haven't seen, or really, you know, really that hasn't, you know, come across my desk in, let's call it, the last probably 10 years or quite 10 years.
It makes sense when you say it. I was just really surprised to read it, but it did bring back nostalgia. Like,
oh my God, I've bought this book on digital and social marketing. Like,
well, the other interesting thing that I've
I'm surprised you still got me on the podcast. At least have my say.
The thing that I'd add to that, though, about that is that my experience with people, you know, who are in that younger demographic now, is that they don't particularly like or use email. And I think that it's actually, I actually think the handwritten thing is always going to be more relevant.
Bring it back.
Because the thing is that, yeah, most people I sort of know in that younger demographic, Everyone talks about email. Younger demographic people don't use email. They have an email account to sign up for things. They don't use it.
They use Messenger a lot.
Yeah, they message people.
Yeah, they use Messenger, WhatsApp. They're more instantaneous.
Yes.
And it's more about, you know, it's more about being able to have that conversation quickly. It's why Snapchat has taken off, you know, amongst the younger demographic, primarily because they can share those messages, they can share the voice, share the video really quickly as it happens, and get that message across and get that response back. You know, it's why, you know, Facebook Messenger has the audio record function. It's, you know, people couldn't be bothered typing anymore, so let's just, you know, send audio messages. You're right, that's the email is becoming less popular, especially for the younger demographics.
If someone sent me a letter and folded it in the way I used to fold complicated letters back when I was in year nine, I would buy anything they were trying to sell me because I feel so nostalgic about that.
You know, unfortunately, I'm bound by confidence, but I, you know, if I had to share something, I do, you know, talk about it in principle in the book without going into too much detail. But, you know, the client in particular that I used, it was a high end sell. We're talking a six figure contract generated from that strategy. So, you know, it's literally that client conversation started off with them asking me about SEO, you know, search engine optimization, which for me could have been a significant monthly retainer, and literally within half an hour advice and a half an hour phone call, I said that, you know, just try that. You know who the people are. It's easy to find the names and the addresses of people now. So use that to your advantage and then send them a handwritten letter. And you know what? If they don't call you back, so what? You know, it's taking you 15 minutes to do a handwritten letter. But if they do give you a call because you've taken the time to address them individually in a personalized manner, then you know, make the most of it.
I'm going to try it out. One of my favorite parts of the book was you telling the story coming from humble beginnings, starting in a trade, eventually moving into a professional career. It's an inspiring story. What advice do you have for those people who might have started in a trade but would like or are hungry for something more?
Yeah, it's really interesting sort of, I guess, how that all happened. And, you know, growing up, I guess, in a fairly low socioeconomic family, but with very good values, you know, working class Maltese family. You know, my mum stayed at home. My dad went to work and worked his ass off every day for his entire life until he was forced into retirement. And for me, what I realized is that, you know, I had to pay my own way and I had to find my own way. And I saw what my parents sacrificed was, you know, buying a house to give us a really good education. And so that education became my sort of platform for growth. I was very fortunate. My parents only asked one thing of me, or my dad in particular. All he asked of me was that I started from the ground up. You know, was that I pushed a broom before I told people what to do. I see it in all professions. You know, you've got these people that go to university, come out, you know, they might work in an entry-level job and within a year or two they're in a supervisory role telling people what to do, or they come out of university assuming they know it all. And it's amazing how little, you know, I whilst I value education highly, interestingly, I would take hands-on experience for the people I employ, I take that over a marketing degree any days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that to me, and like I literally just employed somebody who has been in the marketing space, who's worked his way up from telemarketing right through to email marketing, through to CRM, through to marketing automation, has done that over, you know, over his, you know, 25 year career. And because, you know, without the degree, because to me, the experience is worth so much more than the qualification.
Yeah.
But yeah, to I guess answer the question about what I would say is that there has never been, and I mean never been, a better time to be entrepreneurial or to take the skills you have. We have so much access to incredible technology, you know, connections, networks, information. There is so much out there, and there's never been a better time if somebody's not satisfied or quite happy with where they're at to build themselves or to create the person they want to be, or to grow into the profession or the career that they want to be. Just because they've started off in a trade in particular doesn't mean that, you know, that they couldn't get into a professional role. It just means you've got to work a shitload harder, to be quite frank, to get there. And that's the bit that I was never scared of. I was never scared of hard work. I started working just before I turned 14.
I love that story of the car radios, because it was quite nostalgic for me. It's classic 90s.
It was.
Oh, the car radio installation. I really liked that.
Totally. That literally funded that. I mean, I worked two jobs. I worked at Jules Supermarket back in the day. Good old Jules. Good old baby.
There's so much nostalgia.
Yeah, it was incredible. Back from Campbelltown, and worked at Jules, and then I also worked at the Reject Shop, and then I also did car stereos all whilst studying and going through high school, and you know, installing car stereos. The thing that I, I loved about that was that, again, this was me sort of finding my way to make a living for myself, or to be able to buy the things that I wanted for myself and for my family, and not be, you know, not be limited to, I guess, the wages that I was earning at the supermarket and at the reject shop. And what I found was, you know, it was a cool little strategy. I basically asked, you know, word got around. I did a car, I started off, my sister's car was the very first car. She was the guinea pig. and I figured out I knew what I was doing and I could make things work. And then started, you know, people started slowly getting some faith in me, and I, one job led to another. And what I'd asked them to do was I'd asked them to go and get a quote from a major car retailer at the time who's no longer around these days. And I basically said, look, get a quote from them, figure out exactly what you want. You know, let's talk through what you want, but get a quote from them and I'll beat it by 50%. And I was working out of my parents' garage. I had no overhead, so I'd literally, and my poor Mr. Wilson next door used to get so annoyed because I'd be testing the stereos at all hours of the night. Yeah, I said, you know, get a price and I'll bet it by 50%. And then I made a connection with another audio retailer who sold a lot of the gear, and basically started getting massive discounts because I said to them, I'll keep buying, I'll come and keep buying all of my gear from you if, you know, if you give me a really good price so I can, you know, we could beat the competitor that I'm going to do the installs. So of course I got in with the store manager and I got those deals, and yeah, and that sort of, that literally, you know, up until my early 20s, I think it was, that I stopped, and I made really good money. It was really cool.
14-year-old entrepreneur. Well, I know I'm feeling dangerously knowledgeable.
I'm
after
very
that.
Dangerous knowledgeable.
And I hope the people listening do as well. Where can people find your book, Kevin?
Everywhere. So main channels, so Booktopia, Amazon, it's, you know, iBooks, Kobo, it's in bookstores. So it's not in all bookstores, but if you go and ask the bookstore, they'll absolutely be able to order in. Not every bookstore stocks it on the shelves. Mm-hmm. Quite a few do, I know, interestingly in the city. And most of the capital cities around the country, but yeah, if you go in any bookstore and ask them to look it up, they'll be able to get their hands on it. So yeah, it's pretty much available everywhere, both in hard copy and digital.
We can find you on your website, kevinspiteri.com.au, and Facebook and Instagram.
My handle's Kevin A. Spiteri.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time tonight. We really appreciate it. And I really did genuinely enjoy the book. And I'm actually going to be, I thought the best place to read it from was, you know, our podcast, our little podcast that we've started, and thinking, well, can I relate what you're talking about to this little tiny startup with no funds? And I could. I found it really interesting and I found it workable. So it really is a great book.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time out to have a chat to me.
Listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favorite authors.